that's where we're going to be putting a great deal of our efforts.
So, Midge, do you have some final words regarding the Fair Chance for All?
Well, I think that it's an opportunity. It's an opportunity to really do something that will be effective for, unfortunately, a growing number of people who have had engagement with the criminal justice system. And I think that it's important to know that if we do this, as Ken said, it's for all of us. I think that it strengthens us as a community. It strengthens us as a society to ensure that everyone has an opportunity to contribute and also has an opportunity to earn a living so they can support their families and support the communities in which they live. Mass incarceration has had a huge impact on the economic viability of African American communities in particular. And I think that this is another thing that, you know, we hope to address by giving people an opportunity to earn, to build stable communities, and to contribute to the neighborhoods in which they live.
And Brother Allen?
I just think we need to think big picture about the positive impact this can have on the ability for an offender to come out and get a decent job, to take care of their family, to develop a great relationship with their children, and turn their lives around. And that's what we should be trying to do, is help people to turn their lives around and not reoffend. I'd rather have somebody come out and live next to me that got a good job, a good paying job, than somebody that hasn't been helped whatsoever and is scrambling to make ends meet and doesn't have a good future. So I think this is a real positive program that we should all get behind.
So, Midge, you want to remind our listeners one last time of how they can find out about more Ban the Box, Fair Chance for All.
Right. They can go on the website, www.fairchanceforall.org, and you can find out all of the information there, or contact the Urban League. We would be really happy, and that's www.ulpdx.org, and we would be happy to speak to people about how to get involved more in the campaign.
All right. So, brothers and sisters, we're at that witching hour. I'd like to thank you very much for joining us on the eve of the November 2014 election. I would urge you all to get out there and vote. I know you're not going to the polls, but I'm hoping you're turning in your ballots, or you've already done so by now. I've had a wonderful conversation with Midge Purcell. Ken Allen, and it's truly been a pleasure being able to highlight the common works of a Black advocacy group and organized labor in their efforts to restore the hiring practice, fair hiring practices, in order to help people regain a living wage. And so, again, thank you very much, folks. There's a lot of passion out there. We've had a great conversation with two people who do have a passion. And so what I would urge you to do is to get out there and find your passion, because heaven knows there is a lot of it here in Oregon. Thank you very much, and holla. See you next month.
Okay.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Tune in to KBOO on Tuesday, November 4th from 6 to 9 p.m. for election night coverage. Lisa Loving, Delphine Crescenzo, and Don Merrill will host 3 hours of talk about the elections from the KBOO perspective and include special guests, KBOO reporters in the field, and members of Oregon community media phoning in from all over the state. We'll talk candidates, measures, winners-losers, voter disenfranchisement, and more. Again, that's Tuesday, November 4th from 6 to 9 p.m. only on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Unions and the Fight for $15 brunch and discussion on Saturday, November 15th at 10:30 a.m. The event features Elizabeth Alexander, Vice President of Politics for SEIU 1021 in the San Francisco Bay Area, and Nicole Grant, President of the Washington Young Emerging Labor Leaders. Again, that's the Unions and the Fight for $15 brunch and discussion on Saturday, November 15th at 10:30 a.m. at the AFL-CIO Oregon, 3645 Southeast 32nd Avenue in Portland. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it is Prison Pipeline, so stay tuned.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime, and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Nanta Srinagisai. Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. My guest is Rusty Butler, a Native American Siletz tribal member. Hi, Rusty.
Hi, Karen. First off, I just wanted to say thank you, Karen, for allowing me to be here tonight on the show. And so my name is Rusty Butler, and I come from the Confederated Tribes of Siletz Indians, which is located on the central Oregon coast, kind of by Lincoln City and Newport. Our tribe originated from the Rogue River area, which is Northern California and Southern Oregon. And I come from many different bands. We were moved to the reservation in Siletz. So I work for the Siletz tribe as the alcohol and drug prevention coordinator. And I work mainly with the youth in our community, not only tribal youth, but all youth in our community. And I try to address the drug and alcohol issue, not only to the youth, but to the whole community and the tribe.
Rusty, were you raised on the reservation?
I was raised on the reservation for the most part, up until my 14th birthday when I had an encounter with the law.
Rusty, can you talk about some of these significant events that led to your early incarceration?
Well, I think some of the things that led up to my incarcerations was really making bad choices at such an early age. Some of the things that I was doing at the time, you know, I was drinking and stealing and robbing and just living a really fast life. I didn't have any male role model in my life or no father figure. I was raised by a single parent, you know, and my mom was working most of the time. And so it was really just about trying to identify and be a part of something in the community. And I guess I found that through the gangs and my friends and my cousins that we all used to run together. And we, at the time, it was all about reputation. You know, we lived our life to try to get the baddest reputation in town. And that was kind of the community norm back then. is whoever was the toughest had the best name, so to speak, you know. And so living that fast life of violence and alcohol, and some of my, you know, friends and family were on drugs, and it was a nonstop battle, it seemed like, to survive. I was getting really bad grades in school. It was my first year in high school. And I got involved in a crime that there was a group of us that decided that we were going to do a robbery. And as a result, one of the older gentlemen that was an adult at the time ended up shooting somebody. And as a result, we all got sentenced until our 21st birthdays, all of us that were under 21 years old, or actually all of us were young teenagers at the time.
And who was this?
Well, he was somebody that we had known. He was a friend of the family, and it was somebody that we looked up to as a role model that got us caught up in a lot of different stuff that we shouldn't have been caught up in at such an early age. And then, you know, when we went to trial, the judge didn't have any sympathy for us, you know, only being 14 years old. My younger cousin and I, we got the most severe sentence that we could get for only being 14 years old, and that was sentenced till our 21st birthdays in the Oregon Youth Authority. And so we ended up doing every day of our time.
Talk a little bit about your experience in McLaren.
My experience in McLaren, well, back then when I first got to McLaren, it was called CSD, Children's Services Division. It wasn't called Oregon Youth Authority. And McLaren had been there when I was there for over 100 years. And it was ran kind of like a boys' home. But we were put in the back of the facility, which they called the compound, and we were put, it's kind of like a maximum security unit for youth. And the unit that we were on was a treatment facility. Like, it was a treatment unit for people that had committed violent offenses. And some of the offenses of the kids that were in there were murder and attempted murder and really heinous crimes like that. And so the focus of the program that we were in was to try to pretty much break us down and then rebuild us back up. They wanted us to feel remorseful for what we did. And so in a lot of these groups that we sat in, they actually made us role play, and they brought in autopsy pictures of victims and, you know, even blew them up into poster-sized pictures and could put them in our face and, you know, to try to get a reaction out of us, because that was their way of breaking us down and making us feel remorseful. So another experience with the system we had, me and my cousin, we spent 6 months in the Lincoln County Detention Facility in Newport, and we started requesting that we be able to pray and have our spiritual items. And right off the bat, we were denied, you know, access to our feathers and to our smudges and stuff like that. And so we started writing letters wanting people to come in from the outside, mainly our family, to support us on our spiritual beliefs. And eventually we got that passed, and we were able to conduct the ceremonies that we needed to. And we changed policy there at the detention facility for other Native kids. And then the beginning of 94, when we moved to McLaren, we started requesting Native American ceremonies inside of the unit that we were on. They had already caught wind that we were coming to the facility and that we would be requesting Native American ceremonies. And so right off the bat, we were being denied. And so we wrote letters to the superintendent and the administrators of McLaren. Every week we wrote letters requesting that we were able to pray with our medicines and be able to sweat. You know, every adult prison in Oregon has a sweat lodge, you know, and none of the youth facilities had a sweat lodge. And so our intentions was to get a sweat lodge there to support all Native American youth. And we were being denied for almost 2 years, and we finally, our family ended up hiring an attorney, two attorneys out of Portland from Lewis and Clark Law School, and they came down and they supported us. And we met with the administrators, and within 2 weeks we had a sweat lodge built, and we were allowed to do our ceremonies, and we had access to our feathers and our medicines and the things that we needed to pray the way that we knew how to pray.
And you were only 14 years old and making demands in a prison environment.
Well, I think, you know, for the most part, our family has always stood up for Native American religion. And we know our rights as Native people, and coming from a sovereign nation, especially Native people, you know, that we have rights, and not only rights, but responsibilities to carry these cultural beliefs and traditional beliefs on. We believe that our ancestors, you know, fought and died. A lot of our ancestors believed in these ways, you know, and it's our responsibility to make sure that it continues for our youth and the generations to come. And so my understanding was it was our constitutional right to be able to pray that way, and they were violating that constitutional law of the Freedom of Religious Act, you know, by not letting us do that. And so we stood our ground even when we got denied, and we stood up for what we believed in. And really it was about the only way that we knew, you know, knew how to pray, and we never ever been to church or anything like that. That was our belief, you know. And so we were really passionate about making sure that we were able to set precedents, you know, for all these things. And
so was it just you and your cousin to begin with? And how did others come to join you?
Well, it just started off being me and my cousin that were on the, actually on the same unit. And we started sweating. It was just me and him. And we had family from the outside that came in and conducted the sweat lodge ceremonies for us. And at the time, we were the only two doing it. And eventually, they started allowing other youth. The only way they would allow other youth is if they showed proof of being Native American and having a certified certificate that they that said they were enrolled. And so our struggle with the system continued, and we started requesting that other Native kids that didn't have certification of Indian blood be allowed to sweat with us, because even if they didn't have their card, it still violates the Freedom of Religious Act if that's the way that they believe and if that's the way they want to pray. The unit I was on didn't recognize these ceremonies as part of our treatment process, and eventually we invited the counselors and the psychologists out to sit inside of one of these sweat lodge ceremonies with us so they could see and experience what it is that we actually do in these ceremonies. And they came out and they experienced that, you know, firsthand. Then they acknowledged that the things that we were doing in there should be recognized as part of our treatment plan. And so they, I guess we earned the respect of the system when it comes to our sweats and the things that we do in our lodges and the importance of why it is that we were able to do these things.
And singing is part of your ceremony, Rusty, and you do sing.
Yeah, I sing, and a lot of the songs that I sing are for ceremony. We sing our songs as prayers, and the songs that we sing all mean something and have, you know, have a significant value to them. The beats of the songs, the rhythm of the songs, and the words of the songs, they all mean something. And so we sing these songs as part of our process, our healing process.
Can you sing something for us right now?
Yes, I would be honored to sing a song. This song here that I'm going to sing, I actually made this song for my son. He's 4 years old. His name is Chetne, and Chetne means elk hunter from the Sixes language, which was one of the bands that I'm from. And so in the song, you'll hear the word Chetne, and then another word you'll hear is Dishchu, and that means elk. And then the other words of the song is Chetaganasha, which means you're going through the woods hunting and tracking. And so I call this song an elk song.
Aya deshu chetaganasha, aya chedne chetaganasha, aya deshu chetaganasha, aya chedne chetaganasha, aya deshu chetaganasha, aya chedne chetaganasha.
Thank you, Rusty. Mm-hmm. So Let's talk about when you were released from McLaren. Did you go back to the reservation?
Yes, when I got released, I moved back to Siletz, and at the time, I felt really out of place, felt like I didn't know my community, I felt like I didn't know my family. My mom was really the only one that kept consistent communication with me while I was locked away. And it was really a struggle for me to try to make that transition back to the community. And so there was a lot of hardships that I faced, you know, that I didn't even realize I was going to face. And, you know, some of them hardships being, you know, the rage and the anger and, you know, the confusion and the bitterness and the resentments and all these things that I had you know, gathered from not only growing up in the community that I grew up in, but also growing up behind the walls, you know, and spending all my teenage years behind the walls, you know, and it's a different kind of type of lifestyle in there, you know, and, you know, a lot of times we had to do what we had to do to survive, you know.
Did they prepare you at all for reentry to the community?
I wouldn't say they really prepared me. I guess my last 6 months in the system I spent in Camp Florence was a work release center. And so we was able to go out into the community and actually make a couple dollars, you know, before we actually were released. And so we had a little bit of transition, but for the most part, they just pretty much just opened the door and let us out and said, see you later, you're free to go. And that was at midnight, you know, exactly at midnight on our 21st birthdays. So I stayed in Siletz for about a year after I got out, and stuff started getting real hectic for me, and you know, I was dealing with a lot of things that were still going on in the community, some of the same things that were going on when we got locked up. And so we came back kind of into that same situation with the community and
the drugs, the alcohol.
You know, there was a lot of drugs, there was a lot of alcohol, a lot of violence, you know, and there was people that held resentments for us for being involved with what we were involved in, you know. And there was, you know, certain people that wanted to give us problems, you know, and fight with us. And it was just an ugly scene for me, you know, and I felt like I needed to get away. And so I ended up moving to Eugene for about 10 years, and I stayed there and just started working labor jobs and stuff like that, and really trying to focus on myself and my spiritual commitments, you know, to the ceremonies that I have been involved with. And, you know, over a period of time, I guess, when I was living in Eugene, I didn't have a lot of access to those things like I wished I could have. And so I eventually ended up moving from Eugene back to the reservation, you know, and I've been back in Siletz for about 3 years now. And ever since I moved back, you know, I just really been focusing on the ceremonies and the traditions and getting people in our community involved, you know. And I feel like I didn't have very good feelings of moving back to Siletz, but since I've been there, it's been a really good experience for me. And I haven't really encountered too many hardships other than, you know, watching my family and my community go through their struggles with the drugs and the alcohol and the violence and stuff like that. That, you know, it's been an ongoing cycle, you know, in our community and in our families, you know. And I believe it's part of that historical trauma thing, you know, that's been passed on from generation to generation, you know, and not just in Native communities, but every community, you know. Our families are suffering, you know, and going through that. And then, you know, we eventually will pass it on to our kids and they'll go through the same thing, you know, and then maybe it'll even get worse and they'll pass it on to their kids. And so, you know, my efforts are mainly to try to break that cycle. And, you know, and I think in order to break that cycle, we really have to dig deep and understand who we are, you know, not just who we are, but really who we are and where we come from, you know, and our roots, and dig down into our roots of our ancestors and our people, you know, to figure out why we are the way we are. And why we react the way we react and the way we deal with things, you know. And one, I think, for us in our community and mainly for my family, or one of the things for my family, is dealing with that anger issue. My belief around the anger is that the anger is actually a spirit. In order for us to deal with that spirit, we have to make a connection to that spirit and a relationship with that spirit, and we have to feed that spirit. And I believe that if we don't do that, then the anger will continue in our lives and it won't get no better for us. And so in the work that I do back in the community, that's one of the things that I talk about, is making that connection with, with that anger spirit, and not only the anger spirit, but all the spirits that we deal with every day that we have a hard time dealing with, and understanding that stuff.
If you just tuned in, you are listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James with my guest, Rusty Butler, a Native American Tsleil-Waututh tribal member. So, Rusty, what are you doing on the reservation now?
So what I do back on the reservation now, as far as employment, I work for the tribe there, and I'm the drug and alcohol prevention coordinator. I mainly work with the youth, although I do work with some adults, even though I, under my position, I shouldn't. But a lot of the things that I do is on my own time, you know, and I run ceremonies, and I try to get people involved in the ceremonial piece and the spiritual piece and the cultural piece of who we are as Native people. So I think it's really important for people to understand us as Native people because of the historical trauma piece. In the Native communities, we really struggle to find that sense of identity. You know, our culture, our language, everything was ripped away from us, you know, and we were taught new ways of life and new religion and new beliefs. And because of that, you know, our lives had gotten really chaotic, you know, and I believe our parents and their parents and the generations before us that had to go through those things, what they had to go through affects us today. And I don't think that the effects that we're feeling is going to go away anytime soon. I believe in order for us to deal with those things is we need to get back to our roots, our language, and to our culture to better understand of who we are and where we come from. One of the things that I do in the community is I work with the kids and I work with their parents. And one of the biggest issues that I see in the community is the kids, they follow in their parents' footsteps. And I really struggle with working with some of these youth because they have to go home to their homes, you know, where there's drugs and there's alcohol and there's violence and there's all these things going on in their homes, you know, and then their parents wonder why their kids are behaving that way. It's really hard for me because I don't understand why they do what they do in front of their kids, and I don't understand how they can't understand that that affects them.
So, Rusty, do you have a success story to share?
A success story? Fortunately, I see a lot of successful things happening in our community and stories of young people and even adults that have changed their lives around. The most powerful thing for me, I guess, that I've witnessed is these young people that have been really resilient, you know, and coming out of dysfunctional homes and have continued to better their education and make good choices to stay clean and sober, you know, and get involved in the culture and the dances and the traditions. One of the things that I do on my own time is I am a volunteer for the Oregon Youth Authority. And I'm also a volunteer for the Department of Corrections. And so I go in, you know, two or three times a month into these different facilities, and I help to conduct sweat lodge ceremonies or pipe ceremonies or just any Native American ceremony that they're wanting to do, you know. And I go in and I'm a part of that, you know, and I go in and I support them. And the reason I go in and support them is because I feel like just because they're locked up that we shouldn't turn our backs to them. You know, they're still part of our communities, even though they're behind the walls, you know, and the effects that they have on, that them just being incarcerated had on their families and their communities. I think it's really important to support our brothers and sisters behind the walls, because eventually a lot of them will get released and they'll come back to our communities. And a lot of the kids that I work with, their parents are locked up, you know, and so it's an opportunity for me to go inside of these places and say, you know, I'm doing work with your children in the community, you know, and this is the effects that you're having or that you had on your children, you know, by making the decisions that you made, you know, and going down the path that you went down. And, you know, I believe that a lot of the people behind the walls during the time that they were incarcerated, they were under the influence of either alcohol or drugs, you know, and I believe that over 90% of the people in the system were under the influence of something when they committed their crime, not to justify what they did, because that don't make it right, but it definitely altered, you know, their mind and their decision making. And I think it's really important that we give them the opportunity to better themselves and to heal themselves, you know, that so they can get out and they can be, you know, a part of the community and feel like, you know, they don't have that big label on their back that says they're an ex-con or they're a prisoner, you know.
Well, Rusty, you certainly are an inspiration.
Yeah, you know, I really appreciate you saying that, you know, as being an inspiration. And I don't like to look at myself as that, you know. And, you know, a lot of times when I do these ceremonies and these things, you know, it's more of a responsibility for me, you know, and I don't do it for the glamour or the
glory.
The glory, you know, it's just, it's a part of who I am and it's a part of my culture. And I believe that it's a part of our process in healing, you know. And that's the reason why I do what I do, is because I was told that it's a responsibility of mine to do these things. Not so much my right, but really a responsibility.
I'd love to hear another song.
So this song that I'm going to sing, the words is Nukuntanaye and Nuela. And Nuela is with us and Nukuntanaye is our ancestors. And I sing this song, it's calling to our ancestors to come help us, you know, and to guide us and give us understanding in our lives.
No, 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 Ela, no, Quintanaye. No, 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 Ela, no, Quintanaye. No, 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 Ela, no, Quintanaye. No, 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 Ela, no Quintanaye.
Rusty, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Karen, and I want to thank you again for allowing me to be here, and it's an honor to be able to come and share a piece of my story and my life.
You have been listening.